Recent financial problems in California have prompted some concern about city and county jobs. The city of San Bernardino declared bankruptcy, as did Stockton. But in Los Angeles County, after months of campaigning, home health care workers have won higher wages. The tens of thousands of workers who provide in-home care to low-income seniors and people with disabilities will benefit from the wage hike approved unanimously by the Board of Supervisors. But while they celebrated the change, advocates say their fight to improve conditions isn't over. FSRN's Leilani Albano has more on the story.
Union member Renee Davis has spent much of her life caring for her loved ones.
I took care of my mother and father, and nursing is in my family, so I guess that's in my blood.
But with the meager wages she earns in home care, she's had a difficult time caring for herself. Things will be a bit easier following the L.A. Board of Supervisors' decision to give pay raises to home care workers. Davis will be getting a few hundred dollars more in her pocket each year. The pay raise affects 130,000 Los Angeles County members of SEIU United Long-Term Healthcare Workers. They'll be receiving $9.65 an hour, which reflects the living wage ordinance that the supervisors had previously established and increased to its current rate. The board's decision to increase their wages by an extra 65 cents follows several months of meetings and mass rallies in front of the L.A. County Board of Supervisors headquarters.
Oh, God, it was a wonderful thing. Hard work, but we did it.
Home care workers serve low-income seniors and people with disabilities who are enrolled with the state's in-home supportive services program. They provide vital care such as shopping, bathing, feeding, and administering medication for their clients. But for all the work they do, paid caregivers are among the city's poorest, with nearly half earning near poverty and poverty incomes, according to the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. Kimberly Yvonne, Chief of Staff for United Long-Term Care Workers, says the wage increase serves as a major boost for workers.
That 65 cents could make the difference in paying the rent and getting medications for themselves to stay healthy.
Economists say that the wage hike won't just mean a bigger paycheck for workers, but will bring about other economic benefits as well. According to Beacon Economics, an independent research group, the living wage agreement will bring more than $36 million in income for workers, as well as about $9 million in tax revenue for state and local entities. Yvonne says that as the number of seniors continues to rise, home care work has become the most cost-effective means of providing care to this growing population.
So everybody is trying to fight for a living wage and a wage that actually respects the work and the vital work that these individuals do.
Millions of Americans provide informal care for their sick or elderly family members and friends. However, they are seldom, if ever, compensated for their work. That changed in L.A. County after Parson, as well as a handful of other women, decided to unionize home care workers. In 1999, 75,000 county workers won union recognition. Union officials say it was the largest victory for labor since the United Auto Workers won unionization in the 1940s. But even with union status, she says her earnings still weren't enough for her to survive and also take care of her mother, who had suffered a stroke. In March, union members waged a protracted campaign demanding that the Board of Supervisors bring their pay scale to a living wage of $9.65 an hour. What pushes you to stay on this kind of work?
To make it better for the consumers and the people that we take care of. Because we don't make a lot of money. And even with the $9.65, it's a struggle.
In-home care has served as a lifeline for the poor and elderly who would otherwise go without services. Scott Mann, spokesperson for the union, says being enrolled in the program allows families of clients to avoid the more expensive option of entering institutionalized care, which the union says cost the government about four times as much as in-home care.
So they're barely getting by on their own. Without IHSS, there's no way they could afford private agency. They would end up in an institution.
Keeping loved ones at home is what motivated home care workers like retired AT&T worker Carmen Roberts to join the union. After seeing how happy her elderly father was being taken care of at home, she decided to make home caregiving her profession.
For them, it gives them a sense of
belonging and being able to still keep their pride.
The fight isn't over. Even with a living wage, home care workers barely earn enough to make ends meet, and they also receive no sick leave, no vacation time, and have no retirement plan. Again, Union Chief of Staff Kimberly Yvonne.
This is just the beginning of really trying to figure out how to bring some economic equality to the work that people do.
In addition to the living wage agreement, the Home Care Workers Union scored another victory last month after the Coordinated Care Initiative was signed into law as part of the state budget. The union says the measure aims to standardize home care practices throughout the state. Leilani Albano, FSRN Los Angeles.
This story was made possible in part by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation. And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Molly Stentz and Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
And that was more of Sarah Marlowe. Actually, that was our first bit of Sarah Marlowe for the evening. You are tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM. And this is Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the August 2nd edition. It is the 2nd, right? I just lose track of time. I'll be with you for 2 hours. My name is Robert Norris. The name of the show is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm going to be playing kind of a special, in a way, show I've been waiting to play. Although I hadn't really planned to do it today, but it sort of I stumbled across it, and I think I'm going to do it. This is the audio for a forum, or really more precisely kind of a debate or exchange that was held on community TV and is now being broadcast at various times. I think there's one more broadcast coming up on the Sandra Lee's show, and I don't know, I think it's called Issues, the show, or she has several shows. One of them is called Issues, and I do a regular rant on that show, but she has a second show, too. I'll be announcing the time of that show, which I think is playing, maybe playing tonight, it may have already played today. It's on Channel 27. For those of you who actually get community TV, you can find the show by looking for, I guess, Sandra Lee, L-E-I-G-H, Presents. The name of the, the subject matter of this particular discussion is discrimination against disabled people at the Homeless Lack of Services Center. That is what they call the Homeless Services Center, which I raised as an issue about 2 months ago with several disabled homeless folks, Andrea and Mia, in the studio, and they talked about this at length. It's an archive show, which if anyone's interested, you can get in touch with me, and I'll point you to the proper archive. It's not quite been properly filed, but it is available. If anybody's interested, I'd be happy to do the work to point you to it specifically. But this is a discussion with Mayor Don Lane, who is on the board of directors of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, and he's also, of course, a big defender of that organization. He's been on their board on and off for the last, well, it's been around for about 15 years, but he's been connected with homeless issues for 20, 25 years almost. Yeah, I actually first came into contact with him in 1988 when he was running for city council for the, I think it was the second time, possibly the first time, but the first time he was successful. And I guess the progressives got a 6-to-1 sweep and then proceeded to harass the homeless more mercilessly than had ever been done before, sort of a not unexpected. Well, it was actually, it was not that unexpected for those of us who were watching the election, because we saw what the previous progressive majority, which was, I think, 5-to-2, had done in the 80s. Anyway, Lane and Dr. John Colby, he's a doctor of, I think, philosophy, has a degree in one of those subjects. And it's also on the show is Steve Plaich, who is a familiar voice to those of you who listen to the show regularly. He does suicide prevention, needle exchange, running for city council, was involved with Occupy Santa Cruz, and is a regular participant in Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom and the Santa Cruz 11 defense team. He's all over the place, that Steve Plaich. And he even gives us reports on what's going on. His positions are really not mine. We have two distinctly different positions. He's more of a politician than I am. He's very well spoken, or at least diplomatic, if you will, which I sometimes find something that is to be criticized rather than to be praised. But he's the third person in that show. And then you have Sandra Lee, who's the host, who raises issues. And I'm going to be interrupting it from time to time with my own commentary. But what I'm going to try to do, though, is I'm going to let the show proceed to play significant segments, and then I will pass on my thoughts and commentary. I was in the studio, and the show was being filmed or videoed or put together, taped, perhaps. And I was kind of fidgeting off to the side and somewhat furious with some of the people who are on the panel for shutting down other people and not allowing the real issues, which is what is Don Lane, both as director, board of directors of the Homeless Lack of Services Center and member and mayor, going to do about specific abuses that have been uncovered out of the Homeless Lack of Services Center. Instead, they sort of ended up with a, oh, you know, we all need more resources, sort of whitewash conclusion, which I didn't like at all. But I'll be talking about that more specifically as we proceed with this, and I encourage you to call in, too. There'll be, you'll have an opportunity to make comments yourself, 427-3772. 427-3772 is the call-in number. I'll be mentioning that one again in case you have to race for a pencil, a pen, or whatever to make a note. That's the number to call for the studio, 427-3772. And I'm going to begin playing this now. I think there's a musical interlude that begins it, so a little patience may be required.
Well, hey, folks, here I am, Spilly Chili, and I'm here with a very illustrious panel tonight, and we're here to talk about a topic that's pretty dear and near to me. A lot of you probably know that I am homeless, and a lot of you probably don't know that I'm homeless, but today we're here to talk about disabled people and what sort of care they're getting here in the city and the county and at the Homeless Service Center. And I've got a wonderful panel here today. I have with me John Colby, who's a disabled homeless advocacy person. He's here to kind of represent some people. I have with me Steve Plaich, who's an attorney but also running for city council, and he's also going to answer some questions for the Homeless Service Center. And the illustrious Don Lane, the mayor of Santa Cruz, is here representing the city tonight. Even though he is part of the board of directors at the homeless thing, tonight he's just going to be here as an observer and put in some few words through the city as best as he can. Now, this is really a county issue, and it really should fall into the county jurisdiction, in my opinion. And we've asked numerous people from the county to be here tonight, and they all refused. And I'm very disappointed in all you county people. I would hope for more from you, especially on an issue as serious as this. And you should all be disappointed if any of you are watching this from the county or know somebody from the county that isn't watching this. You should tell them that, hey, you blew it. You should have been there for this, because this is important. We're going to address a very sensitive issue here in the county. And so let me take a second to let each of our panelists just take a second to introduce themselves. And so I'll start here on my right with Mr. John Colby. Go ahead. Tell the people who you are and what you're here for.
Hi, I'm John Colby. I'm a postdoctoral researcher and advocate for various people and causes. And presently, one of the causes or people that I'm advocating are disabled homeless people who are using the homeless services on the Homeless Service Center campus at 115 Coral Street. And in coming to do this, I just started advocating for these people about a month ago. And I hate to warn you, but I basically have a lot of negative stuff to say, because all I've run into so far have mainly been problems, so I don't have a lot of positive things to say. But I thought that I would run through the story of how I became an advocate and these people's stories, and maybe that would give people a sense of what's going on.
Okay, John, well, we'll get right to that, but let's introduce the rest of the panel. I have here Steve Plaich. Steve, why don't you tell the people a little bit about yourself?
Oh, thank you, Sandy. I am Steve Plaich. For the last year or so, I've been the director of the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project, and we've tried in our way to offer some legal assistance to some of the homeless community that find some barriers in terms of resolving tickets or getting services or, you know, anything having to do with any impediments of not understanding the legal system. Also was a member of the Legal Strategy and Defense Working Group for the Occupy Santa Cruz. And at that time, when we had a large homeless encampment in San Lorenzo Park, I got an opportunity to really engage with some of the homeless community there and some of the people who had some disabilities and some problems working through the system or accessing services. So that's my experience in the area, and I found it to be, you know, a very profound experience for me, and I'm trying to find find ways that I can be of service and be helping people as they maintain their status as homeless residents of our city. And that's pretty much what my position and my activities have been over the last year or two.
Perfect, Steve. Well, thank you for being here. And then, of course, we have Don Lane. Don, just take a quick second and say hi to everybody.
Hi, everybody. and I should introduce myself in terms of this issue that about 20 years ago, I was part of a small group of people that founded the Homeless Community Resource Center, which now is the Homeless Services Center at 115 Coral Street. And I've been on the board of directors there most of the last 20 years. I also, for a brief time in there, actually was an employee of the Homeless Services Center as the fundraising director. Since that time, I also helped found Project Homeless Connect, which is a project that takes place once a year at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium to connect hundreds of homeless people with services in the community, and also connects hundreds of non-homeless people in the community with homeless people in the community, just to build some human relationships around homelessness.
And I just want to take a quick second, folks, that we had a wonderful event back in March at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium, which was kind of a group effort from many different organizations and trying to help as many homeless people as possible. And I saw both Don and Steve out there, and they both offered assistance. And I just want to take a second to personally thank both of them for being at that event. You know, it was crazy that day, and a lot of people were frustrated. But you know what? When it was all said and done, I came out of there with quite a bit of information and a lot of people out there that wanted to help me. And I can't thank you guys enough for doing that. But tonight's issue is more about the handicap thing. And for those of you that don't know, we have a wonderful organization over there by Costco on Coral Street. It's called the Homeless Service Center. And they try to help a lot of people. And granted, you know, they're not probably doing the best of jobs, but they're trying. And they've helped me out a little bit. But I've seen some things that could be fixed and some things that need to be addressed. And that's kind of why I wanted to be a part of this, is that, yeah, this is a great thing we have. It needs a little bit of touch-up. And so what we're going to do, folks, is that we're going to listen to some complaints. Then we're going to try to talk about it and come up with some sort of plan. So we don't want this to be a bitch fest. We really want this to end up being something positive. But to get to something positive, we're going to have to start off with the dirt. And I'm going to ask my panelists to be patient. And we're going to give John here the floor to tell us kind of some of the things that are bothering him.
Well, about a month ago, I started advocating for 7 or 8 disabled homeless people who came to me pleading with me to represent and advocate for them, because they were finding themselves on the verge of being homeless, or I believe 1 or 2 of them may actually have already been homeless at that point. For example, Megan Andrea Morgan and Ron Skinner were 2 individuals who both used walkers, who were staying in a hotel room, and they had 2 days worth of hotel, and in 2 days' time they were going to be on the street. So they came to me begging me to advocate and represent them and to help them get a place in a shelter. And to describe just a little bit about Ron is really emotionally and physically fragile. He can't survive on the streets. And Andrea also uses a walker like Ron does, and she has severe fatigue and exhaustion, and she takes medicines which would make her a target for robbery. And she's also a woman, so she would not be safe on the streets either. She can't defend herself. So essentially, if either of them were on the street, they'd probably, at some point, they'd be dead. So that's how I came to advocate for them, and I was able to, I believe, with my advocacy, was partly helpful in getting them a places at the Pauli Loft shelter. While I was advocating on their behalf, Steve Lazow, a disabled person who is in a wheelchair, his legs are paralyzed, he has no use of his legs, he was evicted from the Pauli Loft shelter because his friend Mia, who's female, assisted him with taking a shower. Basically, what she was doing was assisting him in exercising his disability rights, because he has, under the law, he has the right to have someone assist him take a shower, whether it's a female or a male. But the staff member who evicted them on the basis, although no written explanation was given, and they were given no due process to appeal the decision, supposedly it was because there was a female in the male shower. So he was put out into the parking lot, and he was sleeping in the parking lot for one night. He had a serious staph infection on his leg. It was causing him a lot of pain. He called the paramedics, but the paramedics refused to examine or even treat his leg. They refused to even examine his leg. And so he slept for that night in the parking lot of the homeless service center. So I basically sent an email to the mayor and to the city council asking that that situation be remedied. And the next day, he was reinstated at the shelter. Stan Willis, another individual, is dying from colon cancer. He's unable to get treatment from his physicians or from the what's called the Homeless Persons Health Project. I'm not exactly sure why they're not serving him, but I have some suspicions, but I don't know why, and I haven't been, and we haven't been able to basically get to the point of me being his representative advocate to get that moving. He needs 24/7 access to a bathroom because of his medical condition, but unfortunately, the Homeless Service Center shuts down the bathrooms for about 4 or 5 hours a day. So people who need use of a bathroom on the campus who aren't staff aren't able to use them. And then yesterday, another person, this person whose last name is unknown because she's of Hawaiian descent and she doesn't even know her last name. Her first name is Stormy. She's 60 years old. She's diabetic and confined to a wheelchair. She came to me through another person begging me because she had a one-night bed at the Poly Loft shelter last night, and she was staying there on a day-to-day basis, and so she was pleading with me to represent and advocate for her to gain more permanent housing. So basically all of these people and several others are all people who have been advocating and representing themselves with the system, and they've all fallen through the cracks. They haven't gotten service. Haven't gotten on the track to semi-permanent housing, to more permanent housing, to permanent housing. Some of them have been chronically homeless for up to 10 years, and the system isn't working for them. It's just not working, and they're not able to make it work for them, and that's why they need me as a representative and an advocate. And unfortunately, it's been a very problematic process just to get to step one of allowing of the agencies on the Homeless Service Center campus of even allowing me to represent and advocate for them. And this gets to a little bit of the attitude of the Homeless Service Center, is that Shelley McKittrick, the program's manager at the Homeless Service Center, told me when I met with her that their facilities are not equipped to handle disabled people. And I think that she doesn't really understand the legal requirements of their operations, that under federal law, that disabled people, homeless or whatever, beneficiaries, should have an equal opportunity to benefit from the Homeless Service Center's services, programs, and activities. So you can't deny people who are disabled services just because they're disabled. I wanted to address, Mayor Lane and I corresponded with him, and he opened up a discussion with me, and I believe he wanted it to be more of a personal discussion, and I'm very much a believer in transparent, open government, and I believe that everything should be done out in the open and publicly, where it can be seen and where it can be dissected and where it can be heard and where there can be no room for misunderstanding. So I basically carried out this conversation on indie media and on other venues so that it was out in the open, because that's how I like to do it. And from what my understanding is...
I don't think you're going to get much more open than this. We're right here, dude.
Okay, well, from what my understanding was basically from one of the emails you wrote me, Mayor Lane, that you felt...
No, we're not going to get into specific the bartering. Let's continue with your concerns with the clients.
Okay, well, okay. Another concern with the Homeless Service Center is that Ms. McKittrick, the program manager at the Homeless Service Center, claims that the city of Santa Cruz has authorized the Homeless Service Center security guards to patrol private property in a two-block zone surrounding the Homeless Service Center campus, enforcing certain rules on private property, which I believe is illegal, and I don't think there exists such an agreement. And
well, that's kind of getting off track now, John.
Okay, but the last thing that I'd like to say is that there's been a lot of talk about the 180-180 program.
There has.
And what I don't understand, which is completely baffling to me, is why these people I'm advocating for, who are the most vulnerable amongst all the vulnerable people in wheelchairs, in walkers, people who are dying from cancer and who are incontinent, why they are not eligible for the 180-180 program, why they are not part why they're not being processed and being moved into this program. I just do not understand that at all.
Well, I think we'll try to address that a little bit. Well, from what I see, you guys, John's got a couple real good issues here about care for handicapped people at the Homeless Service Center.
And actually, we're going to pause here for some comments that I'm going to make. And again, I invite listeners to call in with their experience, their comments, their thoughts about this. And again, I'll be giving the time so you can actually see the people who are talking on the actual television program. It's interesting to hear John, and moving to hear John talk about the specifics of individual cases of disabled people, the cases of Andrea, of Mia, of Steve, of Stan, of the Hawaiian woman, and so forth. But the real issues, unfortunately, the ones that don't get really addressed, I think, you'll have to be the judge of this, you'll hear the rest of the show, are what the procedures are for dealing with disabled people out at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, what the procedures are for dealing with anybody who, for example, is expelled or evicted for any reason. Do there have to be written complaints that are made specifically, or is there a written kind of document that someone who's expelled can look at and say, take to another higher person and say, look, I dispute this, I have these witnesses. And it turns out that if there is such a process, it hasn't been communicated to me or John Colby or, as far as I know, anyone else. It's all very informal, which, of course, is very, can seem very cozy, but can also be very dangerous because it means that people who are, inside the process make decisions without any transparency to the greater community, without any real accountability to either the clients that they're impacting, the other clients that are watching, or the community that might wonder about what's going on. And also, it doesn't provide for any due process or fairness for the people who are facing a punitive decision that puts them out on the streets. It all has to be said, by the way, this is in the context of very, very limited accommodations. The Homeless Lack of Services Center, well, I call it that for a very good reason. You know, there's a shelter space in the Paul Lee Loft for less than 50 people each night. That's of a population of 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people, scores of whom at least are seeking shelter and on a waiting list for the Paul Lee Loft. And so we are talking about a relatively small operation that gets a lot of publicity and press and pats on the back and glowing reports from the city council and even downtown association types, although there has recently been a lot of criticism of the Homeless Lack of Service Center from the far right, Take Back Santa Cruz, and from certain factions on the city council, not so much criticism as they're responding to criticism, but the fact that Charles, what's his name, the guy who stabbed and killed the camouflage co-owner, we have a phone call coming, and don't give up, phone, or we're going to put you on the air here in a moment. That the fact that this guy stayed there for a couple of days and somehow that trying to hold the Homeless Lack of Service Center responsible. Let's take this call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Free Radio. This is Lighthouse Linda.
Hey there, Linda. Have you been listening to the show?
Yeah, I heard it a little.
Cool.
My friend's here, and I'm listening to it through her ages.
Oh. Well, what do you think?
You were asking a question about disabled policies existing, and I thought I could answer that. But, I could get in trouble. I could be wrong.
Oh, well, go ahead. Give it a try, and if you get in trouble, I'll beat you up later.
I think if you're talking about the campus at HSC and HPHP, there aren't a decent understanding of what the disability law is, where it affects homeless people, let alone a policy of how one would deal with their grievance or how one would deal with the answer to their grievance. It doesn't exist because part of the law that requires it says it needs to be posted what the procedure is, and somebody would have seen it if it was posted. And I've been into their office where their client support is, and you have. Of course, there's been changes of personnel since then probably, but it's not posted.
Yeah, I haven't been out there recently. I have been reading a lot of John Colby online, and he does outline in great detail posting his emails to Don Lane, to the personnel at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, to the city council, to county agencies about the specific concerns he has. He makes requests for public records, and he is, in my impression, frequently getting stonewalled, which really is the issue to me here. I mean, they try to transform it into, oh, ain't it a shame that we don't have resources, and why ain't the county here, instead of, well, yeah, there are limited resources, and yeah, we wish the county were here, and yeah, but the question is, what actual protections and procedures are there in set up in place or not set up in place that are impacting not just the disabled people there, although you might say many, many homeless people just by virtue of their circumstances are disabled, but everybody who uses those services, and many people use the Homeless Lack of Services Center for things other than shelter, because there's so little shelter that they use it for, you know, a mailbox,
yeah,
they use it for food.
Shelter.
Go ahead.
It's mostly not a shelter, you're right.
What's your thought about that? I mean, I'm more concerned with that issue, and as you listen to this show, I think you'll find that Don Lane, you were actually there in the studios, I remember, Linda, you heard
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I watched him make that
He never
show.
Answers that question, and Sandra Lee, unfortunately, does not really allow that question to be put in a close enough and sharp enough manner for the audience to be aware that Lane is intentionally not answering that question.
Maybe
what
he doesn't know, but I know they don't have it. I know that one of their staff said that to John Colby, that they assume all their clients are disabled. I know they don't have that capacity, just reading their grants and the narrative of how they deliver their services they have to turn into the government every year. They don't have a coherent and therefore a legitimate system to deal with people who come through there who are already disabled, end quote, meaning legally and medically recognized as disabled, or disabled because they've been ostracized and abused and kicked out of the social fabric, or become disabled like you could slip in the shower there. You know, they have insurance. They don't have a policy and procedure that's coherent to deal with disabled people.
And I guess
so there's not a lot we can say about what's wrong with it, other than it doesn't exist.
And see, I'm not interested in saying what's wrong with it specifically. My concern is that those who are running it are not interested in this discussion. They are interested in deflecting this discussion. They are interested in avoiding this discussion. They are interested in diverting it. And that's why I think it's really important to keep the focus on the issue. I mean, yes, certainly the rule should be posted. Yes, there should be a policy, for sure. And in fact, there is a policy. It's an informal policy if they do whatever they feel like doing usually on a de facto ground level of whoever's the police power in force at the moment. And
okay,
that person is generally...
That's not what I meant.
Let me finish. And what that means is that somebody like Steve Lazo in the wheelchair gets kicked out, and he doesn't have a way of appealing that process other than if somebody like John Colby, who has a lot of punch and is very articulate, writes immediately to Don Lane and then publishes online what he's doing, and Lane then rushes over and says, hey, they're making a lot of stink. Let this guy back in. That's not a very good policy.
I don't even know that happened, that Don Lane has that kind of power over there. But you can say that's a policy, and I understand the way you mean by default of it being a policy. What I meant was there's an Americans for Disabilities Act criteria at policies for anybody serving a public or walk-in facility that has human beings has to offer to their disabled ones.
I understand.
That doesn't exist. That's what doesn't exist.
So
I'm referred to the Department of Justice.
I mean, and we heard their excuse. You'll hear their excuses for that. Oh, you know, we don't have the resources. Oh, we got to get it all together and so forth. My point is there isn't a policy for people who aren't disabled. They don't have a posted policy for that either. They don't have a written policy that I'm aware of for that.
Well, I agree with you that that's a grave concern. But if you're not disabled or one of these status-protected minority groups like gay or Latina, then they... they don't get any distinct policy unless they fight for it. And that's the few policies they have come up.
Well, that's really what my show. That's what my show is about. It is fighting for it. Mostly it's about exposing it, exposing the fact that, as you know, 20 years ago, actually almost 20 years ago, within a few months, you and I were involved in fighting to protect Linda Edwards from, you know, Karen Gillette's mobs and abuse and brutal physical assaults and discrimination and exclusion out there. It wasn't called the Homeless Lack of Services Center then. It was called, I believe, a free meal was becoming the Homeless Community Resource Center, but it was the same essential.
The Committee for the Homeless was the only legal entity over there.
It was the same essential, you know, the same essential group out there, although under different leadership. They did whatever they wanted. They were under the authority at that time of the William James Association. Now that, you know, they have, I guess, they're their own nonprofit cover, whatever they do. But the fact is,
they may do what they wanted, Robert, but I noticed that with Paige Smith on the board and his daughter staff support for the place, they did respond when I made a question on Linda's behalf, like what John Colby is doing for the disabled people that are being tossed around there now. They did respond, and they responded within 4 days. And we
What did they respond with, Linda?
I demanded a formal administrative hearing because they didn't have any, you know, they kind of wrote back, well, we don't know what the next step is.
Right. They didn't
have. They were open to finding out. And they responded in a timely
and what was,
way.
What
and
was
it's
the
nothing like what you're calling the story.
What was the outcome? What was the outcome?
They apologized to Linda. They tightened up where they get their food policy. And they stopped throwing people off the meal site, which at the time may have just been 4 or 5 hours that we were allowed on the property anyway, who were drunk. They decided that it would be behavior-based, not can we smell alcohol on your face for drunks. That just sort of came up in the discussion that flowed from the formal hearing.
Did you follow that up to find that they actually enforced those policies or follow them?
Yeah, for quite a time, and then there was structural changes in their administration and new programs came in. But through Linda, who didn't want to go there for a while, but she would go over there to kind of keep tabs on the place. And at the time, I had a lot more time on the street, so I just asked people that I knew had lockers there different questions about how things were going. So we monitored it, and there was some integrity in the response, but, you know, we were only asking for the things related to Linda being abused on the site and the administrator then turning away and pretending it didn't happen, and Linda's issues about the quality of food. This is probably right when she began to be sick from what killed her, and it mattered to her.
You know, I think it wasn't just that they turned away. I think they actually encouraged violence against activists out there who were giving out literature, just as now they are trying to exclude activists who want a table.
I think they were more illegal then toward activists, but Linda was also a client, and they were kind of more consistent then. Because of the porta-potty flambé in your yard, I know that's how they treated activists.
Well, no, that's something else. That was a personal. To discuss this on the air is a little confusing to people who don't know the history. But the reality that I'm concerned about, you know, I don't mind talking about it. It just seems to be, you know, wandering off into the wilderness of yesterday. But the authorities, whether it's Karen Gillette and the Homeless Lack of Services Center back then, or the Homeless Community Resource Center, or a free meal, or Paige Smith, who wrote me a lengthy letter denouncing us for supporting Linda, as I remember. It was activists, and this is something I wanted to say, who created the free meal. It was activists who created it originally as Calamity's Cupboard. We actually set up meals and feedings at the town clock that the city tried to did jail us for throughout 1989. And finally, then Mayor Marty Wormhout, after, you know, twisting and turning and bringing out the police and bringing out the county health authorities, doing everything she could to shut us down, finding we wouldn't shut down, agreed that, you know, Jane Immler, then one of the primary activists involved, should set up Calamity's Cupboard, which they then, of course, failed to provide a certified kitchen for. We began protesting again, and the management shifted to Karen Gillette. So it was activism that created that whole process out there, that whole, the entire center. I mean, you know, the liberals got the appropriations later, and they appointed the people and so forth. If you want to call them liberals, I don't know, they don't seem too liberal to me these days.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I mention that because I think that that was some of the, you know, the missing or misstated background that Lane got into. Anything else you want to say about this? And you're welcome to call in as after I play the next segment, you know.
Just that I feel Linda Edwards asking for a grievance and being answered with questions was part of that activism. We had some activism going on many facets and many levels of society. And that
okay,
was
you,
very
nobody knows who Linda Edwards was. Maybe you want to say who
you
was.
You just said it a few minutes ago.
I don't think
a dead woman that was a homeless activist. And
yeah.
She held out in Berkeley and San Francisco and Santa Cruz and then the movement about homelessness in general. And she died because of liver cancer. And before that, before she was sidelined because of her cancer, she was an advocate of people getting together. And it was criminalized the way they're trying to criminalize it now in response to Occupy and things, groups like that. Congregating was criminalized even though all the parks hadn't been closed at night yet.
As they're trying to criminalize you with the upcoming prosecutions.
Fucking hell.
For the Peace Camp 2010 of 2 years ago, trying to restore the right to for homeless people to sleep. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm saying what they seem trying to do is to squash the First Amendment and the Constitution by using the lodging law they use on homeless people.
So, I mean, it's particularly egregious to me when disabled people face this, when they say, we'll kick around everybody, but we'll also kick around disabled people. And that, you know, and in a way, I think Colby may have his finger on something because he's aware, apparently, of disability law. He's been working in that field for quite a while trying to get some kind of some kind of understanding for his sister where they're living. I think they have disability problems at the Mission apartments where they live. And so he's familiar with it, and he's become very passionate about this whole thing. And I'm going to try to actually give him an update, try to actually get from him an update. Go ahead, Linda.
And John has taken a very formal tack in how he's dealing with this that requires his, like, really being like an eagle or a hawk and being really consistent. But he might be able to get the Department of Justice to look into this shit before any of the levels of so-called government between here and DOJ realize how remiss they are, it seems like. So we need to give him support on other levels besides the legal one, I feel. Yeah. Make sure he can keep this alive because it takes a lot. I've done that kind of thing in the past, I know.
Yeah, John has put a lot of personal, not just time and energy into these lengthy emails and requests to agencies and requests to the mayor. He had a lot of correspondence with the mayor trying to get him to, you know, address the issues. But he also has given out personal money to homeless people. He's gone out to try to find them hotel rooms and clothing.
Yeah.
He's really a person who cares very deeply about the particular people that he gets involved with. I'm not that way so much. I'm more kind of involved in the principles, but he's really there. He's on the ground, and it's not easy for him because he doesn't, you know, he's kind of a hermit himself, doesn't go out that much. And when he does, I think it's an effort. So I want to really take off my hat to him. Any other thoughts?
No, we're just really lucky that he did that show. It's important. I hope a lot of people see it or listen to it on your show.
Yeah, I did hear that Sandra Lee might be interested in doing a follow-up show, too. She talked to me, left a message the other day. So I'm going to see if we can make a few more comments about this, then we'll get back to the actual the replay of the audio, the video show that was on community TV about disability discrimination out of the Homeless Lack of Services Center. Thanks, Linda. Yeah. Call back if you want.
Okay. Bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye. So, looking over some of the notes, Don Lane went through some of his credentials. He mentioned he was one of the initiators of Project Connect, which HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I with, went to kind of advise homeless people of their rights. That's the one thing that was really missing from both Don Lane's Project Connect and Don Lane's 10-week course. There was no workshop in how homeless people should address police abuse and institutional abuse problems in Santa Cruz. You know, on the ground, here, when it happens, what should they do if they're facing, you know, some kind of phony but violent authority from the police? What should they do if they're being discriminated against? So they have to really go to people who are kind of, you know, outcasts or on the outside. I mean, HUF, for example, is an organization that we weren't invited to speak at the Don Lane's 10-week homelessness shindig, you know, about supposedly covering homelessness, probably because we would have made it really clear that, well, Lane is the instigator, if not the instigator, he is the participant in the creation of anti-homeless laws and a supporter of laws that criminalize homeless people. He's acknowledged that. He supports the sleeping ban. Or I think at one point he said he doesn't know whether he supports it or not. Which means, of course, he doesn't oppose it. So, sleeping ban, by the way, for those who don't know, it's a law that criminalizes homeless people at night in Santa Cruz, created by the Santa Cruz City Council many years ago, and now being seriously enforced. They call it a camping ban, but it actually says, fall asleep after 11 o'clock at night on any public property, even in your own vehicle where it's legally parked, and you are subject to, somewhere between $100 and $200 citation that keeps going up. And now police are threatening to seize people's property, to put them in jail, if they don't just get up and leave when they're rousted in the middle of the night. This is happening. It's been happening for at least 3 weeks, as documented on the police blog. If you go to the Santa Cruz Department Police blog, that's what you'll find. And Lane has had no problem with this whatsoever. I haven't heard a peep of concern about this from him. I'm glad that Sandra Lee, the facilitator of this show and the host, found the Project Connect helpful. Charity is nice, you know, and even charity once a year is nice. But I'm wondering what really useful information she found that helped the 365 days of the year, or 364 days of the year, when this Project Connect wasn't connecting. And I should also be noted, the Homeless Lack of Services Center is under attack from the right for spurious reasons. You know, as I think I mentioned before, the stabber was served there. There isn't enough police monitoring of these homeless people. It's based on the mythology that homeless people are more violent or more dangerous than the people in their houses, the ones, you know, who have all the weapons and the guns and, you know, get to shoot up in the privacy of their own homes and do whatever they're doing. And then come out on the streets and then can go back into the sanctuary of their homes. Homeless people don't do that, of course. The main thing that, of course, is of concern to groups like, I think, Take Back Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz Neighbors, the Coonerty Robinson majority on the council, is how homeless people, visible homeless people, look. That is to say, you know, it's messy sometimes camping. It shouldn't be. And with the participation and cooperation of the city, it needn't be if they really wanted to help in that regard. But they are not interested in emergency shelter. It's only going to be when there's an earthquake or a Fukushima here, you know, or another real disaster that impacts people who are previously housed and financed, that they will feel the need to do anything, because it's not a priority to them at all. In fact, the priority is to get them out of sight and out of mind while pretending to be very concerned about homelessness and evolving and spinning all these phony webs of 10-year programs to end homelessness. That's my view, anyway. I remember John's talking about Megan's severe fatigue. I saw this in the studio when she was here. She was falling asleep. She looked exhausted. She was able, on her walker, she made it all the way to the studio here, which is it's the center of town, far from the Homeless Lack of Services Center, where she spent the night when she came to be on my show some weeks ago. She isn't faking it. If she does, she's a great actress. I don't think she's faking it at all. And again, you know, I just emphasize what needs to be addressed to this Homeless Lack of Services Center is not so much what John Colby and Linda, who just called in, are pressing, that, oh, they're violating the law, you know, the disability people have these rights and they're violating them, although I think that's a key to exposing what's really going on, but that they are really violating the rights of the entire community of clients they claim to serve and they get money to serve, and by not having an appeal process, by not putting in writing what happens when they throw people out on the streets and deny them access to the Homeless Lack of Services Center, which not only denies them shelter for that night if they happen to be, you know, patient enough and lucky enough to get on one of their waiting lists and then wait for 2 to 6 weeks and then go into the Paul Lee loft for a month, which they're allowed to do, and then they get out, they have to go out again. But if they're thrown out on the streets and or they're on the streets and they get ticketed by the police or confronted because they're sleeping after 11 o'clock at night, oh, you're camping, you know, you shouldn't be doing that here, they cannot use the provision of the law that was created by the city council under the city attorney's pressing 2 years ago when Peace Camp 2010, again, homeless activists forced this law through. We didn't advocate for it. We advocated for ending the sleeping ban entirely. What they did instead was they said, well, if you're on a waiting list for this favored organization, the Homeless Lack of Services Center, or the River Street Mini Shelter, you will get your ticket struck off. This is... to me, it's patently unconstitutional. Private organization can't have that kind of power under the law. Although I'm glad that for some people it does allow for them to, once they get hassled, get awoken, maybe get their property confiscated, get rousted in the middle of the night, whether they're disabled or not, then at last they can get their ticket dismissed under this section. That's good. But if there are no guidelines and people get thrown out and off these lists whenever the whim takes a person who's a security person because you're looking at them the wrong way, or because you're trying to help somebody by showering them because they can't shower themselves and you happen to be of the opposite gender, then you are facing not just the citation but fines. And you're facing huge fines if you don't go to court and try to address that. And if you try to go out to the Homeless Lack of Services Center and say, please give me a letter that said the shelter was full, they won't do it. Or if you go out to the Homeless Lack of Services Center, even if you're on the waiting list, and say, can you give me proof I'm on the waiting list? I want to show it to the cops. They won't do it. But then you talk to Monica Martinez, who's the director of the Homeless Lack of Services Center. She says, hey, we do that all the time if it were wanted. But, you know, nobody really asks us for that. In other words, you get the stonewall, the lie. And again, everything is rosy. It's sort of business as usual. And that really was what I hoped would come out of this show, because frankly, I'm the one who initiated this whole process. I asked that Lane come on the air in free radio and debate Colby on this issue and answer his concerns. And Lane was very angry with me for making it a public issue. It is a public issue, of course. And he refused to have anything more to do with me in that regard, refused to come into the station, refused to be interviewed. But when I pointed out, you know, you're the mayor, Don, you know, you're also on the board of directors, this is really your responsibility, apparently he thought about it again. He said, well, if you're not involved, I'll do it. And so he went on the air at the community TV, and you're going to hear more of that momentarily. I'm just trying to see. Again, feel free to call in at some point if you have any thoughts about this, 427-3772, and we'll hear what you have to say. Have you been discriminated out there? Do you think we're being fair? I mean, a lot of people, even the people who are discriminated against, like Mia, have a lot of positive things to say, by the way, about the Homeless Lack of Services Center. I want to say that, too. They do provide meals twice a day. They do provide access to mail if you pay them a small amount of money each month. Although I've heard a lot of concerns about the mail being lost or mislaid or otherwise having problems with it. They have eliminated their storage lockers. I don't think they've returned them. They do have a 24-hour bathroom open, thanks to former director Doug Loisel, where they used to close their bathrooms. They unfortunately do close the Homeless Lack of Services Center, strangely, during the day, unless you are engaged in specific business, this was done, I think, originally before Doug Loisel to facilitate the staff, because it was just, I don't know, too difficult for them to have to deal with homeless people during the day. And Doug Loisel changed that around. He opened up the so-called campus again and said, you know, everybody's welcome here during the day, you know, and please come. Of course, people should really be welcome at night when they need shelter, but there's a very, very limited shelter capacity. Though on a couple of occasions, Loisel did open up the shelter at night during rainstorms, something that Letitia Schwartz, I don't know that she's done that, and I don't know that Monica Martinez has done that. I probably need more information on that. As to the private security guard issue of security guards roaming the area outside the homeless Lackawanna Service Center on private property, when John Colby tried to get an answer from Don Lane on that, he was interrupted by Sandra Lee, who said, no, no, I don't want you to ask those questions of Don Lane. And that question, I don't think, ever got answered. But if you want to find the recent exchanges between Colby and Lee, or Lane, I should say, on this issue, and find out, you know, Colby tried to find out what understanding does the city have with the homeless Lackawanna Service Center. They said, oh, we have an understanding with the city that we have to patrol the area in order to make sure that homeless people don't have any constitutional rights within a two-block area. They don't loiter. Loitering is... no loitering laws are unconstitutional, so you cannot actually call the police on this sort of thing. But instead, they can penalize homeless people and say, oh, you won't get on the waiting list. We won't serve you meals if you loiter in the area. All of this, of course, pandering to the fears and bigotry of neighbors and businesses who want to blame innocent people who are poor and visible and who don't like to see them around there for their own business problems or problems that are created by perhaps a few other people. There are no documents that according to the city authorities, that indicate there is any understanding between the city and the homeless Lackawanna Services Center. So either the city is lying, which is quite possible, the city employees, or, and there are such documents, and it's a hidden agreement or a verbal agreement or some kind of unspoken, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod, or else the Homeless Lackawanna Services Center is lying about it or has a misunderstanding about it and somehow thinks they have to act like the Gestapo on property that is not their own and push people away from that area. To me, this, you know, I mean, I'm a libertarian in this regard. I believe people have to have the right to, and a constitutionalist and person who's, and a civil libertarian, to be able to exercise their rights in public areas. One of those is to sit down. One of those is to stand and talk with a fellow person. And when we tried to set up a table outside the Homeless Lackawanna Services Center, we were told, you're in the no impact zone. You can't be here. He said, we're on the sidewalk, buddy. You know, this is a public sidewalk. So eventually we simply said, wait, why should we even be on the sidewalk? Let's move into the Homeless Lackawanna Services Center itself, because this is an agency that is open to the public insofar as they are homeless or homeless-related, and that's what we are, and we set up in there. They didn't like it, but they didn't call the police on us. The only time I've had the police called on me at the Homeless Lackawanna Services Center was 20 years ago when I don't think they had me arrested. I think at that time, you know, I came back the next day. I was giving out leaflets about issues around homeless civil rights, and the management didn't like it. And that was, that's the same kind of process that's happening now, 20 years later. It's not something I guess one should be surprised about. Anyway, let's hear some more, less of me, more of John Colby. Don Lane, the mayor and director on the board of directors of the Homeless Lackawanna Services Center, and Steve Plaich, homeless persons legal project guy.
I appreciate Don, you know, as a representative of the city, but I still feel a lot of this is county.
Sandra
stuff,
Lee is talking.
I just want to get your feelings real quick on what John said, and well, especially about the gentleman with the shower thing and. The gentleman with cancer. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I can't really speak to that. What I would say is, John, I admire his dedication, his commitment to serving individuals, being their authorized representatives, but I think it's important to step back and take a look at the scope of the problem. In 2011 homeless census and survey, 20%, that's one in five, every homeless person is suffering from some physical disability. And that's the kind of thing, that's the challenge that we have, is to provide services, to provide care, to provide dignity to that number of people. You know, that's a tremendous problem, and it's also a tremendous problem of finding the system to work, the financing, the funding to work, and coming up with a comprehensive solution to really providing the kinds of services that those people need, and I think that they deserve. And that's not a consideration of ADA requirements or what we're doing for the Homeless Services Center, but I just wanted to step back for a second and maybe define for all of us the scope of the problem, which is a large one.
Don?
You know, I think it would be useful in your role maybe to break this down a little bit, because otherwise I could go on for as long as Mr. Colby kind of going down the list, but I'd rather do it in a sense, bit by bit.
Let's just talk real in general about care for in the county for handicapped homeless people. And what we know, 1 out of 5 that's of homeless
that's
people.
That's just physically disabled.
That's physically disabled.
I think the last survey was that about 60% of the homeless who were surveyed identified themselves as being disabled.
If you can include mental disabilities as well, and I don't think it's quite that high, but let's just say for the sake of argument that it's 20% or so, then that's done just defining the scope of what needs to be addressed.
And then I also, mentally handicapped is just as challenging as physically handicapped.
Of course.
I'd say probably it's an equal number, mm-hmm. Steve, of yeah. mentally handicapped to physically handicapped. John, what do you think?
Right.
That's about
the survey that I saw from 2005 basically said that I think it was 56% of disabled folk who were interviewed identified themselves as having some sort of disability, either emotional or physical.
Don, you have any sort of the numbers on this?
Yeah, I think that's a little high, but that's 2005. There have been 3 surveys since then, so I think Steve probably is referencing a more recent survey. But it's, in a way, I'm not sure that really is. It's a large number, so we don't really need to quibble about if it's huge or large. Mm-hmm. It's a big number.
It's a big number.
So
and then so
let me
go ahead, please.
I think it is thinking about the magnitude of the problem, as Steve was talking about, and that there aren't enough resources. So, what Mr. Colby, I think, is doing, which I reflected to him, is he's kind of singling out a few people who he's had contact with and really advocating for them. But the reality is the only way we're going to get anywhere with this is when the whole community advocates for everybody in this situation. And that's kind of how I sort of see myself involved in this, is to constantly engage the community in recognizing the magnitude of the problem and trying to marshal the resources, not just money, but human resources, mm-hmm. to kind of take it on, to get the private sector and the public sector all to pull together to deal with this. One more specific thing I want to address is that it's important to know about the Homeless Services Center campus, which is different than the Homeless Services Center organization, because the campus consists of 3 different organizations. One is the Homeless Services Center. It runs the Paul Lee Loft, the Meal Program, the Rebel Lee Family Shelter, and the Page Smith Community House, which is more of a long-term transitional housing program. Then there's the Homeless Persons Health Project, which is right there with all those other agencies. It's a county government agency. It does a huge array of health care related services, mental health, physical health, medications, even some housing for people when they have the resources. They try to find people housing, sometimes long term, sometimes short term. And then there's the River Street Shelter, which is run by a separate organization. It's run, the Community Counseling Center is the parent organization. It's important to talk about them distinctly because they are a mental health-oriented organization. The Homeless Services Center does not have any special expertise in dealing with mental health issues.
That's true.
But the River Street Shelter does. That's their area of expertise. There's a lot of collaboration between these groups. There's a lot of effort to kind of find whoever shows up there, where's the most help possible. And, as Mr. Colby has demonstrated correctly, there's not always enough resources for all those people there. But to single out the Homeless Services Center as the reason for there to be a problem.
I wasn't singling out the Homeless Services Center. I just want to make that clear. I was singling out that the whole plethora of organizations on that Homeless Services Center campus is that as a whole, the whole system there is what I've been having the problems with, not just the Homeless Services Center in particular.
And I have to agree, just trying to get somebody from there to come on the show tonight was impossible. And if you're trying to do that, but I see
well,
what you're saying, Don.
Sandy, I think we should you know, address that because that seems to be really sticking with you. Why wouldn't the formal representative of the Homeless Services Center
but
come here with
that,
Mr. Colby? And I will tell you exactly why that is. As Mr. Colby has, you know, kind of indicated himself, he does everything in a fairly formal way. Everything's in writing, raises legal issues. Any nonprofit organization that's trying to survive, when they sense a legal threat, as Mr. Colby genuinely represents, mm-hmm. they're going to say, hey, wait a minute, if that's the terms on which you want to deal with us, we're going to be legalistic too. And we're not going to have discussions on television about individual clients or performances.
And they made an assumption, though, didn't they, Don? Because that's not how this is taking place tonight. And
but,
so I think they made a huge assumption that was incorrect.
No, they were exactly right because, as you noticed, Mr. Colby went down and named individuals, talked about their medical conditions, talked about what happened with them at the service mm-hmm. locations. And that's exactly what the Homeless Services Center staff is not going to engage in public because, unlike Mr. Colby, they actually have standards of confidentiality with their clients. Mr. Colby did not seem to have any reservations about talking about, you know, the physical condition and medical condition of his clients. Professionals at the Homeless Services Center will not do that on television because law says that that's not permissible.
And I will say, in HPHP's defense, Homeless Persons Health Project, that I did talk to Matt Nathanson and ask Matt if he'd be willing to come on. And he would have been able to had he not had another commitment. And I think we probably would have been able to frame some questions around what Matt knows about providing services for disabled homeless that would have been really beneficial for the panel. Unfortunately, we just called him too late. He had other, you know, considerations,
okay.
out of the commitment.
Nice,
so it wasn't for a lack of wanting to do it. He just simply had another commitment. And Matt would have been a wonderful addition to this or any panel when you're talking about
disabled. I'd like to respond to the issue of the funding and the resources because that's been brought up with almost...
We haven't got to that yet.
It's a really important issue because basically the real issue that I see is that there are laws in place, the Americans with Disabilities Act, there's Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which applies to agencies which receive federal funding. There's the Federal Fair Housing Act. These all outline people's rights and responsibilities, and these people's rights are not being observed, and the responsibilities for the agencies are not being performed. And so these are legal issues because there are laws which basically establish how things are supposed to work, and things aren't working according to how the law sets out how they're supposed to work. So that's why it is a legal issue. Now, as far as funding, this has been brought up to me before, and from my experience from talking to these different programs, is that I talk to a lot of people, and everyone gives me an inconsistent story of how their program works. When I talk to one person, they say, well, this is how this program works. When I talk to a person, well, that's how it works. No one can give me a coherent story. And so, and even Julie Conway, the housing programs manager for the County of Santa Cruz, told me that this patchwork of programs developed organically. And thus, that's what it is. It's a patchwork. It's not very well defined. Mm. It's not really clear how it works. And so it's basically, as I would say, it's systemically defective. And just giving it more resources, just throwing more money at it, isn't going to necessarily solve anything because you might just be throwing money down a black hole because it's not necessarily the issue where if you give it more money that necessarily you're going to get an equal return on what you're throwing at it.
Very good point.
Yeah. I completely agree, and that's why there's constantly work that I'm involved in to try and change the system. The system is a patchwork, but the flip side of that is that people like the folks you are representing, if there was no funding for those organizations, you wouldn't even be able to come here and talk about it because there wouldn't be a Pauley Loft shelter for us to quibble about whether somebody was getting services or not. So we do need to recognize that safety net services are imperfect, but they're still essential. And to talk about taking resources away from them and going to federal agencies and trying to say, hey, this agency, I think they're doing something wrong, you should cut off their funding,
I never
is a very dangerous
that.
Place to go. And in fact, that's exactly what you're doing. You send a copy of all your correspondence to every federal and state official you can think of and raise issues.
I'm trying to make a personal attack now against John.
But this is exactly what he's
done. All right, but you don't have to make like an attack on him. It's fine that he's doing that, and I don't blame him for doing that.
Okay.
I would probably want to do the same thing if I was getting the lack of response. If you're not getting response here from the people in the city, I think it's perfectly acceptable to go over your head and try to get to somebody who cares. So I'm going to stick with John on that one, Don, because if he's not getting response here, and I kind of see that happening myself.
But let me tell you the other part of that, Sandy. So why is it important for John to get a response when, in fact, most of the folks he represented, as soon as these issues came up, they got resolved. They got taken care of without John needing to
do a
thing.
Can I step in for a second?
No.
They're still not resolved. These people are still...
They're still staying in the Pauli law.
But they're only there for a couple of weeks more, and then they're going to be on the street.
That's the same as every other homeless person in this community, because there aren't enough resources to have more beds for everyone. So they're not being treated differently. They're being accommodated just like all the other homeless folks in this community, which is insufficient but not unfair in relation to other homeless people. And that you are essentially saying that they're being denied their rights because they're disabled. And in fact, they're being denied things because the whole system is failing.
Let's do this,
but that's a good point. The system right there, what I'm gathering and what I so agree with is that there's demand is far greater than the services that can be provided. And for every client that you have, John, there's 10 more people like me that are just as equally needing a place to live.
Right.
And you know, just because I don't have a handicap outside of being crazy, I don't qualify for any of these programs. And so it's a fine line. And here, you know, one of the things why I would like to have somebody from the centers, any of them, is who picks. And you know, the 180 program that John brought up, and I suppose this might be a good time to interject that since we're kind of heading down that path, is for those people of you at home that don't know what the 180 program is they've come up with this program to find out the 180 most needy, hurt homeless people.
Vulnerable is the key.
Vulnerable. People that are going to die. I mean, and there's people out there that are falling apart mentally, physically, and they don't have any place to turn. And that 180 is just a drop in the bucket. I can't stress that enough. And so how do you pick those people? Out of the hundreds and hundreds of people, we got to sort out through John's people, for every one of you, John, there's another 15 or 20 people that know somebody that needs places and help. So, you know, I need to find out, well, who actually picks out those people? Is it somebody from the homeless center? Do you know?
I can tell you a fair amount about it.
Yeah.
So, first, all that's been done up to now is over 300 homeless individuals in Santa Cruz County were interviewed using a nationally developed survey, a health and vulnerability survey, just to get data, who are these folks, what's their story, what are their medical conditions, and so forth. Then that data has been all compiled, and essentially they've made a list based on these objective factors, who are the most vulnerable people. So they are on a list. Nobody has gotten into housing from this. The folks
still the hot box issues,
right,
from what I just read, right, is that... Well, now they're going to go to Section 8 people and try to take people that have been on the Section 8 list and take them off the list and put these homeless people
kind of rearranging the deck chairs.
Let's talk about this, because I think this is a point maybe of agreement here, is that you're correct that that's what's being proposed. There's people who've been on the long waiting list, and those folks are just high on the list simply because they put their name on the list first. And that's not to be, I don't want to trifle with that, but let's think about that for a second. Do we want the fact that someone's been on the list for 5 years, but is in pretty good health and kind of getting by okay, should they get housing first when we know that there's another person who literally in a year, if they stay on the streets another year or another 6 months, they're going to die? Wouldn't there be some reason why we might want to carve out a few spaces so that those most vulnerable people might go to the top of the list? It's not taking anyone off the list. It's saying there's two lists. There's a list for everybody who's kind of in decent shape, and then there's a few people who are really in terrible shape and really have a demonstrable higher need.
And that's very important. But my feeling, and I want all of you to chime in on this feeling, is that what the research says is that by helping these really ill people, this 180 people, we're going to save millions of dollars in the long-term picture from health care, police services, emergency care. Well, that pays for itself right there. Why even mess with the Section 8 people? Can't we justify this program as its own funding source just on that basis alone? What do you think, John?
Well, it's being done in San Francisco.
I would agree with that. I think, if anything, maybe you change the assessment tool around a little bit. But other than that, I would agree with that statement.
But that is what most of the other communities are doing, is they are using different kinds of vouchers from the federal government. That is the source of housing.
Well, why can't we do that? Why?
We're trying to, and you just objected to it.
Well, no, I'm saying let's not take it from Section 8. Let's make it its own source.
Well, some of them aren't
Section 8. I don't see why we should even mess with those people on Section 8. That's a hard list to get into. I've been on that list for years and years. I'm one of those people, but I would almost be 100% sure I would give it up to one of those 180 people, but I don't want to be the one that has somebody else says, oh, he gets it over you, mm-hmm. Especially when this is a self-sufficient program. If they're going to save millions of dollars, let's just right now take it out of Obamacare and take care of these people now. Right. It's all part of the preventative thing we're talking about.
And this
about.
Is the kind of thing, if this local community controlled all those dollars and exactly how that all works.
Well, we are supposed to control it. We're the people.
But we don't.
Well, why is
that,
Don?
I mean, all the, like, Section 8 vouchers and vouchers for vets and all that, those are all federal funding streams. We try and take advantage of them here as best we can. Mm-hmm. Our county's been very successful in getting more vouchers than most other counties. That's still not enough.
Yeah, the vets just
can
got
we talk
to
about funding for a second?
Well, that's what we're getting to.
Because actually,
we're
it's really interesting because I've been requesting through public records request the
go
funding,
ahead, John,
the
ahead.
Funding records for these agencies, for these different nonprofits and these services. And actually, they do get federal funding. They through the county, through different ways, they get it through contracts. They get it through subgrants. They get it through subgrants to the city. They get it mostly through subgrants through the county and through contracts to the county. So they are getting federal money. It's not like they aren't getting federal money. And they get a lot of their funding from private donations as well. But what I'd like to go back to is the point is that I think there's more resources out there than maybe is being let on, because, for example, I've used some of those resources, and I know from using those resources that these people that I'm trying to help, they can use the same resources that I've tried to use, and why aren't they getting the same results that I've gotten with the same resources? Why are they falling through the cracks, yet because I was able to advocate for myself and I was able to represent myself, that I didn't fall through the cracks?
I know. I mean, that's... See, we're again, a point of agreement, I think, because that's exactly what the 180-180 campaign is about. That's a complete recognition. You know, the most disabled, vulnerable, troubled people out on the streets, mm-hmm. in a sense, it makes sense that they would be falling through the cracks because they're not functioning very well. They're barely interacting with any systems at all because they, you know, if they're just not functioning well in general, why would they function well with bureaucrats? So the whole system, the whole 180 campaign, the whole idea is to sort of identify those folks, kind of to use the figurative term, sort of take them by the hand and say, we will just take care of the system for you. You don't need to navigate it yourself. We will, when we have a place...
Well, why aren't we doing that? That's what John's trying to bring up.
Yeah, I'm trying to tell you that it's easy to just say, well, there's money here and there's money there, but it is bureaucracy we're dealing with. That's exact. I mean, I think we're on the same page here, Sandy.
No,
we're
trying I appreciate this. You know, that the
180 campaign is formed because it wants to solve the problem you're complaining about, properly complaining about. And so that's what we're trying to do.
And I do think that it involves a collaboration, because when you're talking about wraparound around support for these 180 people. You're talking about mental health support, physical health support, right. Everything that they need. You know, you're really taking them and raising them up from a very dire situation.
All of the support situation.
So really, it's a wraparound support system.
Yeah, all of the support situation hasn't really been talked about in the 180 program. All they've talked about is housing these people. In San Francisco, what they found is that the support part is a lot larger part than the housing part.
Well, we talked about support part.
No, that's totally part of the local 180.
And what I've read about 180 is that this is going to be a full-term care type, like a senior citizen home, where there's going to be counselors there, there's going to be people there. And I think that's a great thing. And I'm sure most of the people on the Section 8 think this is a great thing. But, like John said, there's lots of other funding sources. Without getting into that, without pissing off a whole bunch of people, we should be able to jump in there and take care of this 180. But unfortunately, and I think we're all agreed here, there's more than 180 people that fall into that list. And and so what is the number? 500? 700? How many people are in that category right now?
And you're listening to a debate discussion on, well, it began as a question about discrimination against disabled people at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, which Don Lane, the mayor, is on the board of directors of, and was exposed by John Colby. And you can find more of his specific claims and concerns online at indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. That's Santa Cruz Indie Media, where he writes about most recently discrimination against one of the whistleblowers there, Andrea, who is facing exclusion for a week because of alleged violence at a meal that she denies he was actually working on petitioning and so forth before. And it's there are no written reports about that incident that are being presented. There are no witnesses who have clear accounts of any abuse by her. She claims abuse by the security lot people. And the issue to me, of course, is while all the bureaucrats are fighting over their tiny piece of the pie instead of going after the real bucks, which are in the military and the police and the huge corporate profits and bank swindles that are happening throughout the country that was, you know, briefly talked about and is still being talked about and still being pressed by Occupy activists throughout the country. We are getting this, see, we're all on the same page stuff. We just need more resources. We have this wonderful 180 program we're going to work on, and, you know, it's everything is okay, don't get excited, and that sort of thing, when in fact everything is not okay at all. And even at the lowest level, which is really the only thing that local activists can address, is what's happening locally. I mean, they can do mass protests. They can, you know, ride a bus to Sacramento and march to Washington and back. But the real power we have is right here. And that, of course, is what was being crushed by authorities last winter and has continued to be pursued by authorities in the Santa Cruz 11 cases and the case of Linda LeMaster, the activist who just called in, you just heard on the air, who is being tried for, again, a peaceful protest against laws that criminalize people, disabled people and other people. And that's an important point, too, that disabled people are being improperly, specifically because of their disability, criminalized for sleeping at night, for God's sake, outside in Santa Cruz. And the police department is having no problem rousting those people as well, though in some individual cases they aren't. I talked to one disabled woman, Diana, at the Project Connect, Don Lane's wonderful event, who announced, said that after she was given three citations in the days after the Winter Armory closed for sleeping. She's a disabled person. That should be the basis for a lawsuit. It should be the basis for advocacy from Don Lane's board of directors, the Homeless Lack of Services Center. But, of course, they remain silent. They want to remain, have a cozy relationship with the police department. They don't want to offend anybody over there. We found that out a year and a half ago, and we asked them to simply say, look, we're full up. Community, you should be aware. That's the reason these people are protesting in front of the county building. There is no space. So why are you arresting them for sleeping outside? Monica Martinez would not issue such a statement, even though it is patently the truth, and she admits it privately. She doesn't want to offend the merchants who want to keep laws in place that empower the police to discriminate, harass, and intimidate poor and homeless people. It's a sad situation. It's a situation that I will continue to talk about. Again, you know, the conversation has gotten away from what can be done locally. And one of the things we can demand locally is that these organizations treat people fairly. And the only way that John Colby seems to have found out is to essentially expose them before the larger media and expose them possibly to, who knows, I'm not sure what kind of legal action is involved, what kind of lawsuits are involved, what kind of Department of Justice action is involved that involves homeless disabled people, specifically in a disabled category, being treated like shit, being treated improperly by organizations that are getting federal money. You know, Lane should have, one of the first things Don Lane, the mayor and board of directors member of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, should have said was, you know, I'm going to look into these abuses and I will address them. He hasn't even gone that far. I mean, that's usually the cover story for bureaucrats who don't want to do anything but are forced to acknowledge there's a problem. You know, the police, when somebody gets shot dead, oh, we're investigating. Lane isn't even investigating. He's just dismissing. He doesn't have any, there's no need to investigate. There's no problem. It's all a matter of resource problems. See, your criticisms, he's saying to John Colby, are just resulting in potentially cutting off funding to our organization because the federal funds will be cut off because we're treating people badly. If you want people to be treated at all, they'll get their one bowl of gruel a day. We'll cut even that off if the feds cut off our money. That's the kind of argument you're hearing from Don Lane. I heard it 20 years ago when they said, oh, you can't give out flyers at the Homeless Lack of Services Center. In that case, it was called a free meal because they'll cut off, the city council will cut off our money, cut off our funding, and people will not get food. Of course, this isn't true. The Downtown Association and the other conservative interests in town made it a point to create the Homeless Lack of Services Center and its prior organizations because people were downtown protesting and they wanted to move them out of there and put them in an area outside, which of course became the homeless ghetto. But even the homeless ghetto is now adopting the policies of discrimination and exclusion, which the gated neighborhoods under Take Back Santa Cruz's lead and Lynn Robinson and Vice Mayor Hillary Bryant's lead are becoming this sort of the kind of the Giuliani solution. Mayor Giuliani was a notorious mayor of New York who went after homeless people with nightsticks and tickets and jail cells to get rid of them. And that seems to be what the processes are happening here in Santa Cruz. And instead of standing up to this, as, for example, organizations in San Francisco do that are getting money, that are social service organizations, they recognize that homeless people not only are being denied, you know, need to get services, but they need to get justice. And if they don't get justice, it's not going to matter. The services are not, one of the services has to be justice. That's not just not on the radar of the Homeless Lack of Services Center of Don Lane, but it is specifically been decided that that can't be a priority at all. In fact, they have to defend and collude with the groups that are criminalizing homeless people. You heard Lane go into this discussion about, oh, you know, here's what's really going on. There are three different organizations out there. Yeah, do any of them have any due process procedures? He might have said, because he's been around there for 20 years, we do have due process procedures. There are appeal procedures for these folks. There is a timely process when a disabled person can register a complaint and get some kind of action. But you don't hear that response. Instead, you hear, oh, we don't have any resources, which is, of course, I'm sure it's true there aren't enough resources, but there are also resources that are being put into, you know, shooting ranges at the police department and golf courses up at, in the Poganip that could be going elsewhere. And Lane is not raising those issues as some, for example, council members in Berkeley, like Chris Worthington, are raising about that kind of same class struggle that is happening up there. Colby's pointing out what I found, too, that when he tries to get information, he gets inconsistent stories on what's happening. And then, you know, the point being that money, who is actually getting the money and how is it being spent and where are the funding sources? throwing money at the problem doesn't necessarily help it. In fact, it can probably hurt it because it gives the bureaucrats more power to keep doing what they're doing rather than correcting the problems that need to be corrected, because they're really there not to get more grant money, but they're there to serve people with what they have. And that seems to be an issue that is not being addressed by Lane. You know, it's an interesting question. What would happen if all the funding were cut off? Which it wouldn't be. What would happen is you'd have a lot of people getting together to try to solve their own problems in large hobo camps. You'd have, you know, as you had in the 30s, and as you have had, you know, in this most recent depression. The problem become visible as you had in Occupy Santa Cruz. People were solving their own problems in the campground that was destroyed by Don Lane's police force when he was vice mayor back in December. And I'm not saying that's a better solution, but the using these kind of false arguments that we are the only solution and you must follow our funding programs and accept the limitations and keep a low profile, or else everything will be cut off and we will all be denied everything and everyone will really be in trouble. No. The issue is that people do not ultimately depend on those resources. We depend ultimately on each other and on understanding what's going on and standing up together and addressing these issues. Not that the funding isn't an important thing. It's good to have. But we have to deal with what's happening locally. This "you are endangering our funding" lament by exposing our abuses is an argument that just simply does not fly. I'm looking over my notes here to try to review if there's anything else. And again, if you have any thoughts, you out there listening, please do call in. 427-3772 is the number, 427-3772, and we can talk about it. The discussion of the 180-180 program is something I'm not as qualified to talk about as I should be. You know, I keep remembering the 10-year plan to end homelessness and a series of other initiatives that are actually ways to talk about the issue and fund a bunch of people to flap their jaws and do very little other than get more money and pretend they're doing something or even believe they're doing something. You don't have to pretend. You know, 300 people were interviewed. They got more data. They're trying to get the 180 most vulnerable people. If they can only get together, people, they'll try to raise money privately to do it. You know, that's fine. But in the meantime, people are being criminalized for trying to meet their own basic needs. And when they are trying to use the services, they're being arbitrarily discriminated against without any kind of due process rights. That's the problem, and that can be solved without spending a lot of money. That can be solved by simply acknowledging what's going on, setting up due process rights, and following them. And Don Lane wouldn't have this problem, but he seems to think that exposing the problem, maybe it's much worse than I know about, is going to result in cutting off funding. Exposing the problem is going to result in the house falling in, or, you know, there is no problem. He isn't even saying there is no problem. He's saying, it's a difficult problem. We need more resources, instead of saying, let's deal with the piece of the problem we have now with the resources we have now. And as I said before, the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz, which he has the option to bring up and try to change, and won't succeed at, but he'll raise the issue if he wanted to. It's clearly discriminatory against homeless people and against disabled people particularly, and also threatens federal funding for programs. I mean, Lane could bring that up, in September at the next city council meeting if he wanted. And that would be a very good reason for getting Santa Cruz to change its laws. But he's not doing that. And I'm actually more, as I listen to this, I'm feeling more positive towards Sandra, the moderator, who is, she isn't, I think, doing what I would like to see, is focusing back on why aren't these services providing due process rights to their clients. You know, there's absolutely no reason that's been presented why they can't. It's just not being focused on, so therefore it doesn't become an issue anymore. But she does point out that, you know, this idea of pitting one group against another, of pitting the Section 8 people against the 180 in Donlan, saying, well, the most vulnerable, what about the most rich in the community, or continuing to sit on large pieces of property, and what about the deals for developers, and what about the processes that the funding that goes to the police department and parks and rec, or to the redevelopment agencies when they were existing and now whatever their successor groups are? What about all the large bunches of money that exist outside these 180 programs, or the pittance that the Homeless Lack of Service Center gets? It doesn't get that much money a year. It's like, what is it, $150,000, something like that, you know, compared to the millions that go into the police department. You know, the huge amount of money that's being spent to prosecute the Santa Cruz 11, or to, you know, to roust homeless camps, instead could obviously be profitably spent in providing a campground. If you can't find housing, give them a campground where they can, you know, have toilets and bathrooms and places to sleep and some kind of safety and security and some kind of community. Or let them provide it for themselves. Let people do that as they did. And, of course, this plea is useless. What we really have to urge people to do is to do it again and defend themselves when authorities attempt to crack down, however they can. You know, Black Panthers talked about self-defense with weapons. You can defend yourself in many ways nonviolently. You can defend yourself legally. There are all kinds of ways of defending yourself. But first you've got to get together and establish what you need to defend, or else it remains highly theoretical. So in the local bureaucracy where Lane, as mayor and on the board of directors, has some power, he isn't interested in exercising that power to either stop the criminalization of the poor or set up due processes for the homeless. He wants to moan and bitch about, oh, I wish we had more resources, and oh, we need to get together and get all these programs cooperating so to get past the patchwork. At least that's what I hear. This is a program, by the way, you're listening to Free Radio 101.3 FM in Santa Cruz. And if you go to TuneIn, on your browser, put that in, you'll find the stream for Free Radio Santa Cruz. Call-in number here is 427-3772. And I'm replaying and discussing a community television show that is actually being replayed now. It actually was replayed today at 4:30 in the afternoon on Channel 27 or 73 if you got to get cable to get it. It will be coming up again Saturday at 6 o'clock and Sunday at 3 o'clock on Channel 27. That's Saturday at 6 and Sunday, the 5th of August, at 3. So if you want to actually see these folks in action and hear them again, you can do that there. Also, the show, the audio portion here that you're hearing now, will be archived at huffsantacruz.org, www.huffsantacruz.org. That's the website for the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, and it meets on Wednesdays. Come on down. Sub Rosa Cafe, 10 o'clock in the morning. You know, belly up to the table, and we'll give you some tea, coffee, or whatever anything we can bribe you with to get you involved in this kind of activism. Or you can call the Huff line at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Let's hear some more of this discussion and maybe your phone calls. Who knows?
That's kind of what I want to know. Do you have any?
I don't know. All
how
I
about
can,
you, John? How many people do you think actually
all I know is from the,
need to be
the,
in
the
program
studies
right
that
now?
I've seen.
Robert, what about you, man? How many people right now need to be in this 180 program? 200? 500? I mean, here in Santa Cruz, how many people do you think qualify for this?
Well, it depends on how many you estimate are homeless in the city. If you figure 50% of the population has some disabilities.
Any idea, Don?
Well,
how many
you
people
figure
do you
what assessment
you guys did the survey.
No, it's definitely more. It's more than 180. It's totally not. I want to just give back up one step just to talk about why is it 180. There's a national campaign that's called the 100,000 Homes Campaign. 180-180 is just the local model, the local version.
Could it be the 143rd city or something
right.
that signed on to it or something?
Right. Yeah. And the whole yeah. idea is that each city out of this nationally, the same concept, exactly what we're talking about nationally, just picked a target of 100,000 and then said to each community, you set your own target as part of that 100,000. We picked 180. It's not, there's no magic to that number. The reality is we need to set a goal because you're right, there's more than that, but
well,
let's
how many
start.
Do we even
well,
know?
But the thing is, we know there's at least 180.
Oh, I know
Sandy.
That much.
So
and
what
I,
I'm saying is we're having
about the door.
We're
Why
having
don't
a hard
we know
enough
more
time.
Than that, though? No. Shouldn't we know how many of you?
According to Linda Lemaster.
Okay.
No, just real quick.
There are over 1,000 legally disabled, known disabled, have seen doctors.
All right, so we have a lady, Linda Lemasters, is it Linda? She's here in our audience, and she's telling us that right now there's about 1,000 people known handicapped, hurting,
and Linda, give us that definition
people.
Again. The definition? They are.
I said these are people known to be disabled, legally disabled.
Known to be disabled, legally
doctors,
disabled.
Meaning they've seen doctors.
They can't right. be on TV.
There are more untreated.
All right, so that's a number. Let's work with that number for a second, you guys. So there's 1,000 people. We're looking at 180. So, you know, that's 820 people that are technically falling through the cracks right now. So,
I'll
you know.
That number.
And I think the yeah, people I'm advocating we are some of those
so
people.
So maybe you, it would be helpful for me to know. No offense, but really, what's your point?
In well,
the
my
sense
point
that
is
if
that
we can't get to 180, we can't get to 1,000.
Well,
so let's get to 180 first, Sandy.
Well,
that's a number we can grab onto and kind of say, let's in the next 2 years get to 180. Doesn't mean it's over then.
Well, I don't think it's over either then. And my point on coming up with this number, Don, is to just have a grip. You didn't know the number.
But,
you know, none of us here really knew the number. And so
that,
I think it's important that we have a clue.
But the 180 is not the only program
well,
that you can envision.
And they're talking about 100,000 people. So
that's nationwide.
Our 1,000 and the 100,000 is just a drop in the bucket, too. And so I'm proud that we're starting. And again, there's so much bickering just about the 180 that Don's right. How can I possibly imagine 820 if we can't get to the 180? But I imagine the 800.
Okay.
I imagine us taking care of all these people.
Well, then
I imagine us being able to do
then let's
this.
Let's talk about how we're going to do that.
And that's the point that we're going to get to now. We've talked about the issue. How can we fix this?
Well,
go ahead, Steve.
Well, Don's got
I really
one
think it's important
we'll
to still
that.
Talk mm-hmm. about the number because that's the whole reason of prioritizing.
Mm-hmm.
You're right that there's 1,000 who have some kind of disability, but some people have a disability. It's real, but it's not going to cause them to die in the next year because they're on the streets. It's a disability. It's an impediment to their functioning well, but they're kind of surviving. There's 180 who we're talking about. There's a different level of trouble. And
well,
that's why we're doing the 180 first.
Can I check something
yes.
here? But the problem, the real issue that is being not being talked about is that those people who aren't being served, who are disabled, is that they're also being criminalized because of the laws which are criminalizing
and
them being homeless. So not only are they disabled and not being able to navigate the system being put on the streets, but then when they're disabled on the streets, they're going to end up in the jails, they're going to end up in the court system, they're going to end up somewhere bad. Because they're being turned into criminals, where they just happen to be disabled people who didn't fit your criteria.
And that's something that I'm trying to address in my small way with the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project. But my suggestion would be is, you know, not to disregard the 1,000 and just look at the 180, but say, how are we going to treat and, you know, this whole 1,000? And I say, you know, use the 180 project as a template. If you want to do something else, use a different assessment tool and treat another 180 who aren't quite that far down. And then you move up to the next level, and next level, next level. And you get 5 or 6 of these parallel programs running, presuming you can fund them, presuming you can get the community to be engaged in that. And then you're dealing with people who have these problems, the whole 1,000, and you're not just isolating the 180. You can do that. I think 180, the one thing I admire about the 180 program, and I do have some concerns about it, is that it's a good template. It's a good approach. It's something we can use and expand into other programs to move up the ladder. You know, the next 180, the next 180. The least, you know, maybe the not quite so extreme cases that are going to die on the streets in the next 6 months if we don't do something about them.
That's great. Don?
Well, go ahead. You were going to go to the next topic.
And where we're headed. So we know that there's a need. We've got a kind of a feel for some numbers now. I want to kind of get your grasp on a path we can take to not only address the other 820, but what's the number of homeless right now in Santa Cruz? 2,500?
Well, according to 2,000.
Around 2,700.
That's Santa Cruz County. Yeah.
So, you know, there's that big issue. But out of that number, you know, I see that there's probably about 500 people that really need to get something taken care of. And I have some ideas of some things that can be done, but what I'd like to kind of address is how can we have people not fall through the cracks, I think is probably the most important thing at this point, is because there are so many falling through the cracks, and having that big event at the Civic pulled a lot of people out of the cracks, like myself, who hasn't done anything until I finally went to that. And granted, I was pissed and frustrated and nothing happened that day, and a lot of other people were pissed and frustrated and nothing happened that day, but we're getting people out of the cracks. It was a step. John, you know, I know you've got some negative things, but I want you to look on the what do you think we can do to stop these people from falling through the cracks?
To address the funding issue?
Well, let's not address the funding issue.
I think to go back to the funding issue, because there's, I think, systemically, the system, like Julie Conway said, it's a patchwork. It's organic. When you go to a government funding agency and you ask for a grant for money and you can't clearly explain how your program operates and you can't clearly explain what your objectives and goals are and they can't understand your program, they're not going to fund you at a very high level. So I think there really need to be systemic reforms so that it's really clear how these programs operate. So there's a written set of procedures. Each organization has a written set of procedures about how they operate and defines all their policies and all their procedures. So then when these agencies in conjunction or singly go to get federal funding or state funding or funding from anyone, that it's really clear what they do, how they do it, and they're more likely to get funding.
And they're going to operate
more efficiently.
An example of that would be the Homeless Action Partnership. And that's precisely what they do.
Right. I mean, you know, it's again, the in Santa Cruz County, there's the organization that Julie Conway kind of helps hold together is that patchwork of organizations, the homeless, and it goes under the name Homeless Action Partnership. And all the organizations dealing with homeless services work together to do one big federal grant application for Santa Cruz County. And Santa Cruz County is way more successful than any other county, than most other counties of its size in getting those grants. And they actually do excellent applications that do show objectives and procedures. They're heavily scrutinized. They're scrutinized both locally and then federally. We have someone who's really talented who works for the Homeless Action Partnership who knows how to write excellent applications.
As a former grant writer, I can tell you that is
excellent. And worth your weight in gold if you can do that.
Well, that's
and
not then the each, picture I got
John
from Julie Conway.
I'm sorry.
Well, I think that, but the patchwork is still, I mean, the picture she's painted is still correct, that it's not like the whole system is each year like saying, oh, okay, let's reinvent what we've, all of our homeless services and kind of unify them and make them one, you know, coherent system, because there are 10 or 15 different organizations that have been around a long time doing different parts of those services. What some serve families, some serve people with disabilities, some serve chronic homeless, some, you know, there's different programs that have meet different needs, mm-hmm. That's what we've got. So you can't go to the federal government and say, we used to do it this way, we're throwing all those out, we're defunding all these organizations, and we're going to just create some new thing. So we do it with the patchwork, and we knit it together as best we can. It's pretty good. It's not great, because we don't have enough money to make it great.
What do you think, Steve?
Well, I think that I agree with what Don says, but I would say that one of the things that is a challenge is that all of these organizations individually certainly understand their obligations under the Americans with Disabilities Act. But do they all have consistent policies with respect to that, or could we all benefit from, you know, like a task force of all these groups similar to the Homeless Action Partnership saying, what is our goal here with respect to the ADA? How can we serve this, you know, disabled community, right, homeless community? What is going to be our reaction and our response to each, to any of these particular anecdotal incidents that happen? That, I think, is what's lacking. You know, to me, from what I see, certainly Don's a board member of the Homeless Services Center, and I know that that board is well aware of their obligations and duties under the Americans with Disabilities Act. It's no mystery. But do all the organizations who primarily address homeless concerns and homeless issues all have consistent policies that really reflect that understanding? That I don't know. I can't speak to, but we could benefit from some collaboration on that level.
I think I have to take issue with you on that, because dealing with these agencies, and I know the laws pretty well because I've had a lot of issues coming out of housing, and I've had to advocate for myself and my sister with regard to these laws. And I go back and I read all the material on these things, so I know them pretty well, and I've dealt with federal agencies about them. And I can tell you that my dealings with these homeless service providers on the Homeless Service Center campus, they do not, in my belief, understand the ADA, the Fair Housing Act, or Section 504, that they are sorely lacking in information and education about people's disability rights and about their duties under these laws.
Well, I see stuff. I mean, Don, with my own eyes, and Steve, you know, I watch what happens, and there is discrimination there, and there is a certain amount of criminalization or even the threat of criminalization to people there needing services. And
this is an important but a different issue.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the same thing, you know, about, you know, just how the ADA, you know, you brought it up. Is mm-hmm. You know, there's a guidelines for how people should be treated, and there's some things that just aren't right. Well, let's get back to the positive, though. And,
all right.
And you know, my thing is what I'm thinking, and I could be way off base with this, but, you know, I see that we need to make our homeless service center, our organizations around this, a little more like the senior center, service center, where we have structured daytime facilities so people can go in and get some training, learn how to do a resume, just like we did at the thing at the Civic, have a big room where we have some advocacy stuff. We have a lawyer. We have some computers that you can do job searching. And have that every day with lights, with power, with a place that they can just read, maybe a lending library. I mean, these, from what I'm seeing, during the daytime, you're a nobody and less than a nobody. And at nighttime, you're still a nobody, but you're not less than a nobody. But during the daytime, you're all given the boot.
Well,
so why can't we have a community center for the homeless people where we have daytime facilities where they can be safe with a roof over their head when it's raining, with services for these people on a daily basis, so that if somebody comes in and says, how in the hell can I find a place to live, that there's somebody there that's going to listen to them, not, well, call us back in a week and we'll make an appointment for somebody who might be there and they might not even like you that day because they're so overworked. And I'm not thinking that's going to cost a whole lot of money to make a room for somebody with some services. To me, with all the other negative stuff that's going on, that would be a small price to pay to start get some of these people off the streets into a structured environment. I mean, a lot of the mentally handicapped people, that poor lady, I don't know her name, she goes into the health project and sits there and talks to herself for 3 hours and leaves. She doesn't have an appointment there. She pisses everybody off around her because she sits there and talks to herself. And all she needs is a roof and a chair. Why can't we provide a roof and a chair for these people? Yeah, please, I want you to
do that. Actually, I did make a proposal. In using the citizen participation plan for the HUD block grants that the city receives, of which some of that money goes to the Homeless Services Center and some of it used to go to the River Street Shelter, was that there be a one-stop shopping center in a central location like downtown where homeless people can go. They can find centralized access to social services, to food if they can't get to some place where it has food, to food, to social services, to transportation, to the shelter, to other services, that they don't have to go and go slog all the way across town just to find that there's no bed for them, that they can call from a phone in a center downtown, preferably someplace like the Metro Center, and they can call up and say, is there a bed for me? Can you put me on the waiting list? They don't have to go through all this rigmarole, but that there be a one-stop shopping center downtown in a central location. There must be some space with all the vacant buildings down there to put something like that in there.
Well,
that is,
can
I,
down,
yeah, sorry, I really need it. You know, both, no offense, you guys, but you're talking about stuff that's really expensive. You make it sound so easy. Oh, it just would cost a little bit of this, a little bit of that. That money is not easy to come by. I used to raise money for the Homeless Services Center. That was my job there. And all I did was try to find money to improve the programs we have. Gradually, we make a little progress here and there, but it's not like we don't have thousands of ideas about how much better it could be if we had more resources. So I just want to be really clear that it's not a lack of will. For instance, some of what you just described does exist at the homeless center. There's an empowerment center upstairs. It's very small. It has several computers. It's staffed for people to do exactly what you just described. They can work on resumes, do look for housing on computers. There's some help for people who are not computer literate. It's not big enough, it's not staffed enough, but it's there. Now the city is giving a grant to the homeless center to improve what used to be the locker bay, to make that bigger, to have that be a much more, exactly what you've described, but it takes a long time. Even with this city grant, we still have to come up with more money to do it.
You give me a suggestion then, Don. Tell me what we can do to get these people off the streets and into the system.
No, that's what I'm saying. I totally agree with you. Your suggestions are just right. What I'm trying to tell you back is not that these are the wrong approach. What I'm saying is it's just not simple because we know it's a good idea to then turn it into a reality that operates every day, that staff, that if people want, we don't really want people just to have a roof over their head. We want staff there who actually can interact with people and say, hey,
but
how can I assist you, get housing, get a job? Yeah.
The problem is that laws aren't being followed. The ADA, Section 504, and the Federal Fair Housing Act aren't being observed.
I just want to comment on what John said, is that I agree that that model is a wonderful idea, and it is about getting the money to be able to do that, but look at what the vets do at Emmeline Center. They have a complete services center there where they have a doctor comes in, they have housing, they have education, they have resume. Go up to Emmeline to where the vets are temporarily until their building opens, and look at their model. And that's exactly what you're talking about. But in order to create that kind of model, it does need money.
Well, how can we get that center involved with our issue? You know, why reinvent the wheel? Why
they
can't
are,
we get
they
our
are.
People
Absolutely.
To issue that?
Oh, yeah. Just so you know, that's really where homeless veterans, if they identify themselves to some of the other agencies as homeless, they are really directed there, and then they do. There's a lot more resources for homeless veterans,
Absolutely.
And they go there and they get them.
All right. Well, we got to wrap it up, you guys. We hit a lot of stuff. So, John, I'll give you a quick second. Just your feelings coming out of this. You know, we address some of your issues.
I feel like that I've heard the same thing that I heard from a lot of government people that I've already talked to. Is basically it's all a funding and resource issue, when I really think it's that the system isn't working effectively, and it's also not observing the laws, and the laws have to be observed, and basically to get more funding and also to make things happen, the system has to work more effectively.
And I agree.
I just feel that it's a very challenging time to be a homeless advocate, but I do think that there are solutions. You know, there are ideas, there are things that we can do and develop, but we have to have, and I think Don and John might agree, and you might agree as well, Sandy, community engagement. We all have to engage in this together if we're going to really come to some kind of that maintains the dignity of our homeless
people. That's why we're doing this, you guys, and thank you all. And Don, any last comments?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly echo that last part, especially that is what, you know, I've spent a lot of my life the last few years just trying to not speak so much an advocate for particular solutions, but an advocate for people in the community to say, you know, we're not dealing with this well. And we need this whole homeless problem, from whatever side you come at, we're not handling it well, and we need more people to put their heads together and say, what are we going to do together to change this? And that's
what we're all talking about today.
Well, what can we do here to get more support for these things? Steve, what do you think we can do to get more support?
I just think raising the awareness in the community. I think there's a lot of myths in the community about homeless people, and I think the more advocacy you do, the more awareness you make, and the more people will really, you know, engage on that and think that, well, you know what, maybe I can do something, you know, to be part of the solution.
And how can we get more money, Don? Who do we have to rub noses with to get cash?
Well,
from?
I mean, there's possibilities in all different sectors. In a sense, there's local private money, which the Homeless Service Center has just over time been more successful to bring more money in to the process. We try to divert some of the federal money that, for instance, the city gets. I've certainly worked, like I did, you know, to get this year some of that federal money to go to improving the day center at the Homeless Services Center. So there, it's just working on all these fronts, trying to get the local governments to restore some of the cutbacks they've made, not just to homeless services, but to social services in general. Right. It takes people just taking that position as voters and as community members.
Can I just one thing about raising the community awareness? Is that they need to know about these people, Steve Lazow, Mia De La Rosa, Andrea Morgan, Ron Skinner. They have to know that there are these people who aren't their stereotypical homeless people who want to be housed and that they're disabled and they're on the streets not because they don't want to work, not because they're bums, not because they're panhandling, but because they're disabled, and they could have some more compassion for them, and then the funds will flow.
Well, John, you speak for them, so they're not voiceless.
Yep, and we're all here speaking for them today.
Yep.
And so, folks, thank you very much for watching this show.
I hope
you got something.
Absolutely.
Steve,
thank you, Sam.
Don, John, thank you guys for all coming out here and being patient. Good night, everybody. Watch this again when it repeats, because there's a lot.
And again, if you want to hear this again, you can. Going to be happening on Saturday. Let's see if we got this right. Saturday at 8 and Sunday at 3 on Channel 27. And, of course, you can hear this again plus my fine commentary if you go to huffsantacruz.org. Very quickly, just a few notes because there isn't much time left. From the Cream to the Dregs is coming up shortly under, I think, alternative host R. Duck is maybe in the studio to deal with that. I'm not sure. I think Uncle Dennis is away, if I'm not mistaken. Let's see. The 180 program, you know, again, he says, you know, well, let's focus on the first 180. Well, why not just focus on the first 20? Why not focus on the first 5? You got to look at the number of people who are really in need. And that is, of course, the figure that Lane doesn't want to talk about. The idea is getting people involved in a little feel-good pilot project for a few people is a way of, you know, I mean, I can understand the psychology of it, but it doesn't get to the real issue, which has to be addressed, that there are thousands of people outside who, if you don't want to criminalize them, or if you insist on criminalizing them for creating their own shelter, then you damn well better provide alternatives, particularly for people who are disabled. But of course, when this flies in the face of, I don't know, privileges for the rich and tax breaks for banks and things of that sort, you know, you have to be willing to confront those large organizations, something that I'm not aware Don Lane has ever done or is going to be interested in ever doing. You know, this business of prioritizing, while it sounds good rhetorically, is also a way of disregarding the broader issue. I mean, is this triaging really necessary? What we need, of course, is a real examination of what is in the budget and what is available, what people should be taxing in order to deal with, you know, the 1%, 99% disparity that's been talked about at length and needs to really now be acted on. There's no talk about the criminalization issue. Only Colby brings it up. Plate says, oh, it's not relevant to this discussion. Yes, it is. I think it's completely relevant because if disabled people are criminalized, this becomes an additional black mark against the services, which knows this is happening, says nothing about it, and actually uses that as a goad for, in essence, telling people to shut up about any of the problems they have or they'll be thrown out into the venue or the milieu where they're going to be criminalized. I like the, you know, Sandra's idea of a, essentially it's kind of like a 2012 Santa Cruz switchboard like they had in the 60s and 70s here in Santa Cruz, although one that's focused on homeless services. But that's the last thing Mayor Lane wants downtown. There's been a big protest against Santa Cruz being the county seat where the jail is and where the Emma Line services are. So this draws all these evil, poor people into this area and diminishes, you know, the Disneyland aspect of the town. So we just aren't getting those rich buyers to come into town and toss their money in the stores. Yeah, horseshit. You know, I mean, that's... I don't believe that's true, but if it were true, I think there are more important considerations, which... are obvious, which is the basic needs people have here. You know, all of this, of course, is begging the basic question that was brought up at the very beginning of this issue, which was the reason that Lane agreed to appear on the show, because he was being embarrassed by Colby's exposure that his organization that he's been on for 20 years, which Steve Plaich assures us knows all about the Homeless Disabilities Act. I don't think they do, or if they do, they're paying no attention to it. I don't know why he's schmoozing and soft-peddling this issue, except he's running for office, he's a politician. Maybe he has more information about it than I do, and maybe I can get him on the air to talk about it. You know, but the fact of the matter is, it is the issue is discrimination against the disabled at these agencies and against people generally at these agencies insofar as they're not having clear policies, not having clear appeal processes, not allowing for due process. And that doesn't take any money to change at all. All you have to do is start acknowledging the rights of people. And that is something that these organizations do not want to do because it denies them the power and the discretion to do whatever the fuck they want to people that they consider to be whistleblowers or gadflies or they're having a problem with or they can't afford to pay for them that day or they screw up with, or their staff is annoyed for some reason, and or their staff is behaved in an abusive manner. They don't want to get sued. They've all got all kinds of reasons, you know, to ignore these issues. And Lane is a prime example of this. So it's about 8 o'clock. I want to remind you that tomorrow there will be tabling for the Santa Cruz 11. That's me, folks, as well as others, stars in this great circus that D.A. Bobley is. Orchestrating, and it's coming up. We're all facing 7 years in prison for what? Being in a building and reporting on a First Amendment protest against the Wells Fargo Bank and in order to also establish a community center last December. We're going to be down at O'Neill's in the area, actually on the sidewalk in front of O'Neill's, and that's going to be happening tomorrow at 5. I invite you to come on down and get more information, find out what's going on. There's going to be also a sleep-out vigil overnight on Tuesday night when Ed Fry is scheduled to report to jail on Wednesday morning. His crime, sleeping in front of the county building back in, actually the courthouse, back in 2010, and providing facilities for 50 homeless people in terms of the only nighttime bathroom, porta-potty in his case, that was available. He did it in ways that even activists, long-term activists like myself, we never provided that when we were doing protests. People had to, you know, find their own sources of, you know, disposal, if you will. So Ed's going to jail for 4 months, or at least he has to report to jail. The word is he may be getting an ankle bracelet, and he may be under house arrest instead. But it's not, that hasn't been assured. Also, Gary Johnson goes to jail August 24th, maybe for 6 months, maybe for 2.5 years, because he was sentenced to 2 years for sleeping with a sign on a bench on 4 successive nights, or I think they were successive insofar as he got out of jail and went back and did the same thing again. Very principled guy, on a bench in front of the courthouse saying sleep is not a crime. Obviously, he was a liar. Sleep is a crime. They proved it by giving him a 2-year suspended jail sentence, and that's going to happen on August 24th. The Santa Cruz 11 is going to be making another video in the studio of Community TV. I'll be one of those who is being interviewed. That's going to happen at 1 o'clock on Saturday in the studios of Community TV in downtown Santa Cruz. If you're interested in being a part of the audience, show up in the studio and join the audience, and that's going to be happening then. And, gosh, there's other things happening, too. There's a vigil commemorating the victims of U.S. atomic bombing at Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 5th, 7 o'clock, I believe. That's when the protest starts. It's going to be at the town clock on Sunday. A lot of things happening. If you want to be reminded of some of these things, you can go to Santa Cruz Indie Media, and I've posted at least one of these things. I got somebody else has posted the peace vigil coming up. A lot of things happening. I'll be back on Sunday, and I'll be in the studio at 9:30. I've gotten some real poignant pleas from a couple in the Poganip are being harassed by the police up there, pregnant mom and her partner. They're being threatened with a seizure of all their property, again, as part of this draconian, we'll show the homeless how tough we are, put them in jail, give them citations, seize their stuff, which is becoming, it's gone from being the unspoken and unwritten policy, actually the written policy, but one that is supposedly done only on a complaint, where the police are now soliciting complaints and going out and looking for campsites along the river and in the Poganip.